Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Horror in Moncton. On Wednesday night, a gunman opened fire in the quiet community, ambushing and killing three RCMP officers and injuring two more. After a 30-hour manhunt, the suspect, 24-year-old Justin Bork, is in police custody. We speak with the MP for Moncton, Robert Gauguin, about the tragedy and the issue of gun control.
This week, the Harper government unveiled its long-awaited prostitution legislation after the Supreme Court struck down our current laws. The bill is already being slammed by critics, and there's talk of another court challenge. To discuss the bill, we're joined by a sex workers advocacy group and the Minister of Justice, Peter McKay.
The new U.S. ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman, sits down for a one-on-one with McLean's political editor, Paul Wells. The two discuss everything from missile defense to the Keystone XL pipeline.
We also look at the call for stricter environmental regulations on the oil and gas sector and the huge increase in complaints about the government's handling of access to information.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. That disturbing audio speaks to the horror that residents in the quiet city of Moncton, New Brunswick witnessed Wednesday night. Around 7:30 p.m., police received a call about a man walking down the street with what appeared to be a gun. When RCMP arrived, they were ambushed. Using high-powered rifles, the gunman shot and killed three officers and injured two more. The officers that were killed have been identified as 32-year-old Constable David Ross, 45-year-old Constable Fabrice Georges Gévaudin, and 40-year-old Constable Douglas James Larch.
Frightened residents were forced to stay in their homes as the city basically shut down while 300 police officers scoured the community for the suspect. After nearly 30 hours, the manhunt ended when officers took 24-year-old Justin Bork into custody. The arrest happened in front of Michelle Thibodeau's home, and the 21-year-old describes what happened.
All of a sudden, one of the SWAT vehicles stopped in front of our house, and all the officers unloaded and started heading towards my backyard, and they were screaming, "Come out with your hands up." He just came out and said, "I'm done," and he had his arms raised, and they collected him from my backyard and brought him to my front yard, and he was laid sprawled out on my front yard for quite a long time. They had a gun to him, but they didn't use it. My heart immediately dropped to my stomach. It was terrifying. We were all shaking.
Bork has now been charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder and 2 counts of attempted murder.
To talk more about this tragedy, I'm joined now by the Parliamentary Secretary to Justice and the MP for Moncton, Robert Gauguin. Mr. Gauguin, can you tell me what the feeling is like after the suspect in this horrific shooting has been taken into custody?
I have to say the principal sort of emotion is great relief because people's lives were disrupted. I mean, we had people who gathered up their kids and their dog and some groceries and headed out because once they headed out, they couldn't return into the cordoned off area. Also, there's an element, of course, of grief because there's much grief for the, you know, the family members of the fallen RCMP, and of course, there's wounded people as well. There's a lot of concern there. There's already people who have started putting up some sort of a memoriam with flowers in front of the RCMP office, and then I guess there's probably the emotion of pride that the RCMP were very efficient apprehending the suspect without further loss of life or wounding. Also pride in the citizens who very carefully obeyed the RCMP's request to stay inside. When I made it back to Moncton from Ottawa, it was literally a ghost town. There was no one on the streets. And I believe that probably made the RCMP's job far easier.
What was it like for you? You were in Ottawa, and to see this happening in your home riding and have to head back there after such a tragedy. I mean, how were you feeling when you first got the news, and how were you feeling as you went home?
Well, it's complete shock. I mean, Moncton's a relatively small city. It's a very peaceful city. It's one where the crime rate is relatively low. It's not one that's accustomed to, RCMP officers being gunned down. So, you know, you come here with trepidation, and willing to do whatever you can. But quite frankly, I mean, the RCMP took it in hand and did a bang-up job. They formed the perimeter, and the accused is apprehended.
many times we've seen this throughout North America and overseas. When people go on rampages like this, there often isn't the same end for the suspect. The people often die doing these acts of horror. What's the feeling like of the people of Moncton and yourself that police have a suspect in custody and that person is alive and it didn't end in a different way?
Well, you can never stop an accused person or perpetrator from turning a weapon on himself. I mean, that's not the RCMP or the authorities doing, but that didn't take place. And the fact that they were able to apprehend him and, bring him to face the justice system, one of the best in the world for sure, I think that basically brings the element of pride into place. And people are very grateful that, one, this thing happened without further bloodshed, and certainly the fact that the accused is in custody.
And one question always in these situations is why? Why did this happen? Are you hoping to get those answers through the justice system?
Well, as the justice system, I guess, gets going and the facts unfold, certainly we'll get a better glimpse at what the accused, his background is, or what this man was unknown to the RCMP. He had no criminal record. The Facebook, page that he put up dates back till September. We're in June. It's not that long. This guy was not even on the radar. I think they found out that he has some association to, the Freeman or something like this, which is sort of an anti-authority type of group, but his links to it were not very, very strong or narrow. So what's, I guess, a little disquieting is that this guy was not even on the radar, and I guess one can ask oneself how many others are out there.
And that sort of leads to the next question of the issue of gun control. After tragedies like this, it's an issue that always pops up and becomes a discussion again. Is there a pause for some review to make sure that that all the controls did as they needed to, and there couldn't have been more done to prevent something like this?
Well, I guess what we're going to have to do is, quite frankly, is gather all the facts and make the proper assessment of exactly what the weapons were. We don't know that at this point in time. I suppose perhaps the RCMP do, but certainly the public doesn't, and I don't. Were they legally obtained? Were they illegally obtained? Were they legally obtained and altered? It's really premature at this point to make an assessment. But, I mean, obviously, as police officers, in the line of duty or gun down, there's always cause for reflection as to, was there enough control or is it sufficient? But certainly that will be examined.
So the government and public safety will take a look at the facts when they do come out?
Well, as in most instances, they'll assess the whole situation. They'll try to determine how it can be avoided that police officers are gunned down. I mean, we think back a few years when in Alberta there was a number of them that were gunned down, and of course this scenario was assessed. Best practices were put into question and improved. Equipment was improved. There's always a sort of a reckoning point that, you look at all the scenario and try to make it better, try to make it safer for those who, keep the peace in our communities.
I just want to ask you specifically about one press release that was sent out by the National Firearms Association. The suspect had not even been caught by police yet. The manhunt was still on when they sent out a release and said, "It is clear that Canada's excessive firearms control system has failed again. The excessive rules in place do not in any way increase public safety, but merely contribute to an expensive and unnecessary regime that harms only those of lawful intent." This was going on when the manhunt was still going on. What do you think about the timing of this release from this National Firearms Association and the message that they're sending out during such a tense and horrific situation?
Well, it's a relatively radical point of view, quite frankly, which I don't think merits a whole lot of comment. I don't share that point of view whatsoever, and I think most reasonable Canadians don't share that point of view. I know south of the border law was made of, trying to put a little bit more gun control more in line with what we have here in Canada. And we saw that failed. So, I mean, if, you want to have values like the National Rifle Association here in Canada, well, you're free to do so in a democratic country. But I don't think that in any way reflects the mainstream thought of Canadians.
Was it insensitive to release something like this while some people in Moncton were still locked in their homes, fearful of a suspect still on the loose?
Certainly lacks tact.
And I don't want to leave on the note of gun control. I want to leave on where the people of Moncton move from here. So what's next for the city of Moncton and the people of Moncton?
Well, you know, as in most tragedies, I mean, things get better with time. Certainly the families of the deceased, it'll take more time. But I think that, you know, we'll band together. Basically, we'll band together to help as much as possible in any way asked the families of the fallen. And we'll make sure that their memory is certainly not forgotten. And we'll soldier on.
That's the Parliamentary Secretary to Justice and the MP for Moncton, Robert Gauguin. For the latest news on this horrific shooting in Moncton, go to mcleans.ca.
On Wednesday, the Harper government unveiled its long-awaited bill to bring in new prostitution laws. The legislation was needed after the Supreme Court struck down our current laws in a ruling that found the laws put sex workers in harm's way. Our country's top court gave the government 1 year to come up with a solution, and that solution has come in the form of Bill C-36.
In it, the government says it will make the purchase of sex illegal in Canada. It criminalizes those who make money off the exploitation of others through prostitution. It prohibits advertising the sale of sex, and it outlaws prostitution in any location where someone under the age of 18 could reasonably be present, such as malls, schools, parks, and residential neighborhoods. Minutes from now, Justice Minister Peter MacKay will defend his bill, but first, we'll get reaction from those that may be impacted by the legislation. Jean McDonald is the executive director of Maggie's, which is a sex workers' action project in Toronto. First off, Jean, can you give us an idea of what the current situation is for sex workers in terms of the violence they face?
They are subject to harassment and threats and abuse by people in the neighborhood, by police, by potential clients. However, many are able to employ safer strategies for working, which includes working in groups, working in pairs, making sure that they can take down license plates, ensuring that potential client is sober and not intoxicated.
So given this current situation, what's your reaction to this new bill from the Harper government?
At Maggie's, we are absolutely devastated by this legislation. We are heartbroken. We know that these new laws, as they currently stand, will mean the deaths of more women and sex workers across this country.
Why is that? Why will there be more violence in your eyes to women than what we currently have now?
This law is a huge step back for sex workers' rights in Canada. This law means that women sex workers will be pushed out of more comfortable areas of the city that they're used to working in, pushed into darker, more isolated spaces, unable to work together, unable to communicate with the client for their safety and well-being before they get into the car. This legislation is a gift to sexual predators. Sex workers will not be able to go to police comfortably because sex workers are being criminalized under this bill through the communication laws.
But only if they advertise or do so in a place that is a public place where children or anyone under 18 might be reasonably present.
I would like someone to tell me where in a city you could not reasonably expect children to be at some point. This law, because it says where children could reasonably be, this means almost anywhere in the city. It's very vague, it is very discretionary, and it does not take into account the safety and security of sex workers.
Now, the argument from the Justice Minister is that this will improve safety and protect vulnerable people because by targeting the Johns and making it illegal to purchase sex, that they are going to be able to get people off the streets who are predators, who are sexual predators.
The idea that you can protect sex workers by criminalizing prostitution is absolutely false. There is evidence-based research coming out of Vancouver, coming out of Nordic countries such as Sweden and Norway, that demonstrate that criminalizing clients specifically increases violence and exploitation of sex workers.
Do you believe that this bill respects the Supreme Court's Bedford decision?
This new legislation laughs in the face of the Bedford decision. It laughs in the face of the Supreme Court of Canada. It laughs in the face of the Constitution of Canada. This bill is absolutely ridiculous. It will not, in my opinion, withstand any kind of court challenge. The only thing that this will do is put sex workers at risk, and we will see more violence. We will see more murdered and missing women across this country. This legislation will just be a continuation of the epidemic of violence against sex workers in Canada.
Has your group been involved in any talks whatsoever with other groups across the country about another possible court challenge at all over this? I mean, it took years to get the Bedford decision in the Supreme Court. Are you willing to go through that that process again?
Maggie's is working with sex worker organizations and sex worker allies across Canada to ensure that this legislation, either it won't go through, or if it does go through, we will continue to challenge it. We do feel that this, we will not go back. We will not go back to seeing our sisters, our friends, our loved ones being injured, being murdered, going missing. It is absolutely unacceptable.
That was Jean McDonald, the executive director of Maggie's, which is a sex workers action project in Toronto.
Now, given the criticism and a possible court challenge on the horizon, I sat down with Justice Minister Peter McKay in his office to discuss his bill.
Minister McKay, in December, the Supreme Court actually struck down the prostitution laws in Canada. And to quote the ruling, it said that they infringed the Section 7 rights of prostitutes by depriving them of security of person in a manner that is not in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. Your bill actually restricts the areas in which sex workers would be able to work, and they say that they'd be forced to go to more unsafe areas, as well as it prevents them from properly screening the clients the way they do now. So given the fact that the Bedford ruling was all about the safety of sex workers, will this bill pass another constitutional challenge?
Well, I believe it will, and we don't bring legislation forward that hasn't been thoroughly vetted and looked at through a constitutional lens, a charter lens at the Department of Justice.
So are you expecting this to be challenged in the court system?
Well, having said earlier that we believe that this is constitutional legislation, that we believe that this will withstand that scrutiny, do I expect court challenges? As sure as night follows day, most new legislation will be tested in the courts. And so I don't for a minute shy away from the reality, which is, as Minister of Justice, as an elected member of the government, we bring forward bills that we think are in the public interest. But let's go back a little further. The important focus of this legislation is to protect vulnerable people, to protect individuals who, through a number of unfortunate circumstances, have entered a very inherently dangerous practice of prostitution. And by focusing on the Johns and the pimps, the classic perpetrators, the abusers, by targeting them with police sanctions, by making their activities illegal, we are taking the emphasis off the criminalization of those who are selling sex and placing it firmly where it should be and placing the responsibility on the shoulders of the perpetrators. Now, on the other side of the equation, the compassionate side of what we're doing, is partnering out of respect for jurisdiction with provinces and territories and organizations who are, in many cases, doing outstanding work already, giving them greater resources to help prostituted women and girls exit the profession, to leave prostitution, to find a more meaningful, healthy, and safer life.
But the sale of sex, as the common phrase goes, is the oldest profession in the world. This bill will not stop that from happening. So the sex workers say this is just forcing them to go to more unsafe and isolated areas where violence against them could more commonly occur. So how is this not forcing this more underground?
I would frame it differently. I would say we're presenting more positive alternatives to exit the the sex trade, prostitution, which we think is inherently dangerous. And let's be clear, by providing that type of programming that gives them what we think are better choices, we're responding to a very clarion call that we heard during our consultations, and that was that the vast majority of prostitutes, women and girls, some men, given the alternative, would leave. Given the alternative, would flee the life of violence that is inherently dangerous.
But there are many cases where women are not trying to get out. There are women who enjoy what they do, who don't want to leave. They're not the subjects of human trafficking or exploitation. What about them? If they're not going to leave, they're saying that in their scenarios, they're actually going to be put in more harm's way. Some people working from home may have to turn to the streets because they're not allowed to advertise online anymore.
As I said, the sex trade, and I believe you repeated some of my earlier words, is inherently dangerous. And we don't believe that there is any single piece of legislation that is ever going to address all of the societal harms that flow from this practice. Having said that, we're looking at it in a multifaceted way with programming. And at the same time, we are protecting our communities by putting these parameters in place.
On that note, though, you say that you're protecting the communities. You're limiting, though, where the sex workers can work. And during your news conference, you had a long list of where it would be illegal for the sale of sex to take place. Churches, parks, schools, residential streets was another one. So where would it be legal for the sale of sex?
Well, I don't think any of those places that you've listed, that I listed, would surprise the general public. The intention here is obviously to protect young people in particular from being exposed to prostitution. And the intention is to, again, place emphasis on helping vulnerable women leave prostitution. And you say that those numbers are few. Our 31,000 participants in the online consultation and the face-to-face consultations that we had, in addition to submissions that we were receiving in addition to the online, indicate quite clearly that the majority of women, predominantly women, given the alternatives and given support for things such as housing, education, training, would make that choice. And that is the preferred option. And so that's why we're presenting the bill in a way that isn't focused only on legislation, it's also focused on social programming.
But where would it be legal for these women and men to have to sell sex now when you've taken off so many options from the list where they can go? Like, give me an example, because you had a long list of examples of where it's illegal.
Well, let me put it this way. It's illegal to buy sex anywhere.
For the purchasers, for the person to sell sex, for the sex workers, where would they go? Would an industrial park be a place where a kid would not reasonably show up?
Look, as Minister of Justice, I'm not going to give people advice where to sell sex. I'm telling you that it is illegal to buy sex anywhere.
What is your message to those sex workers who are frightened and saying that this is going to send them to darker, scarier places to try and sell their trade?
Reach out. Know that there is help available. Know that there is new resources available for women's shelters, for job opportunities and employment that we hope will offer them a better life, a better way. Know that there are people who care and that want to work with them. In the absence of laws that focus on the violence and the addiction and the abuse and inherent dangers of prostitution, in that void, I believe you see an increase, in fact, in things such as human trafficking and addiction. The type of situation has occurred in other countries that we've looked at. And that was, in fact, the case. With both full criminalization and full legalization, human trafficking and more exploitative behavior was the result.
But there have been studies like the one done in Vancouver that was printed in the British Medical Journal saying that laws like the ones you're introducing, where dons and pimps are targeted, that actually does not help with the safety of prostitutes or sex workers. It actually increases the harm towards them.
Well, if you take away the demand and you put in place tougher laws that are aimed at the abusers, the users, those who perpetrate the violence and the degrading activity, I believe you're actually getting to the root causes of what puts women at risk.
That's Justice Minister Peter McKay discussing his legislation to introduce new prostitution laws.
Coming up on the show, we speak with the U.S. ambassador about Canada-U.S. relations. We talk about the opposition's push for stricter rules on the oil and gas sector. And we look at the increasing problem of getting information from the federal government.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up, we speak with the new ambassador to the U.S., we discuss environmental policy with the NDP, and we talk about the limited access to information coming out of Ottawa.
But first, a new Democrat MP has been suspended from the NDP caucus after criminal accusations were made against her. Manon Perrault, who represents the riding of Montcalm in Quebec, has been charged with public mischief over allegations she wrongly accused a former staff member of theft. In a statement, the party has confirmed that Perrault has been suspended but won't comment on the charges since the matter is before the courts. Perrault is scheduled to appear in court on July 15th.
It's been 2 months since the new U.S. Ambassador Bruce Hayman arrived in Canada, and over that time, he's been busy. Not only has he been traveling the country, but Hayman has been facing a lot of questions on some controversial files. McLean's political editor Paul Wells sat down with Hayman for a one-on-one interview to discuss Canada-U.S. relations, missile defense, and of course, the Keystone XL pipeline.
You gave this big speech the other day in Ottawa, and you encouraged everyone to look at the trend lines, not at the headlines.
Yeah.
You kind of have to do that because the headlines are discouraging.
Which is why I said it, really. I mean, sometimes, and I realized this even when I did my first round of interviews, and the headlines didn't look anything like the article itself or the interview. And I read the headlines myself, and I said, gosh, I actually never really said it that way. And so I was joking half with the media team, and I said, maybe I should just do my interviews with the headline writers and forget the people who actually do the story, because maybe that'll have a better impact. And they laughed, and we talked about it. But clearly, I understand the I understand the difference. I will tell you the content of the story between our two countries is really strong and good. But sometimes the headlines are focused on the challenges that we face. But we're going to have challenges. We'll always have some challenges. This is a very large, complex, wonderful, enduring relationship. But I don't care what relationship you're talking about, whether it's personal, professional, corporate. If it's large, it's significant, and important, there will be times where we'll have things that we have to work through. But I think that sometimes we lose perspective when we just look at one part of it.
Have you watched the President and Prime Minister Harper working together? Have you had a chance to do that? Have you been in the room with them yet?
I haven't been in the room with the two of them. I've been in the room with each of them separately, but I have not been in the room with them together.
Okay. How would you characterize the relationship?
Professional. These are two very smart men. They're serious. Mm-hmm. They're roll up up your sleeves, work hard, folks. And I think that they work and talk about serious things that are important to both of them. I characterize the relationship as something that you'd expect of two G7 leaders.
Alan Gottlieb, former Canadian ambassador to Washington under three prime ministers, said that you don't get a lot of progress on the big files, on the complex files, if there isn't a relationship of trust and confidence between the two heads of government. How are they doing?
Well, I wouldn't characterize there's a lack of trust and confidence. I mean, I just don't think these two gentlemen are the guys that are the ones that people want to see this just wonderful, embracing, affable, hugging kind of relationship. And I'm not sure that either of these two guys, that's their DNA. And so I think that the way they're reacting and acting together is totally in line with their personalities and what they're doing. But I actually think that they're behaving appropriately, and I do think they trust each other. There's a strong degree of trust in their relationship because they're working on difficult and challenging issues globally and bilaterally.
Generally, you cited in your speech substantial progress at Vancouver, where it's like 50% faster across the border in British Columbia. I come from Southern Ontario, and it's still pretty rough.
So it's 50% faster from 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
So you have to go back. Sometimes you forget. It's like the temperature changes a few degrees, and you forget how cold or warm it was just a few degrees ago, and you get comfortable with where you are. So number one, Nexus cards are really important. Putting in the technology for Nexus, we've just passed the millionth Nexus holder, and we've demonstrated, and by the way, we monitor times it takes for people to get through the border across the 121 border crossings. What people don't realize is there are between 300,000 and 400,000 people across the border every single day, 1,200 flights. There are times where, you know, the systems back up. Certain holidays, you know, certain events that are taking place on both sides of our border where people want to get to. But for the most part, through most of the day and most of the times, it's moving pretty well, especially if you have that Nexus card. And so I really would like to see an acceleration of Nexus holders.
I'm reading in the papers about missile defense again. More than a decade, Canada has not participated in the U.S. homeland missile defense. Now that's being reconsidered. Is that an active homeland defense program? Is there a desire to see Canadian participation? Would there be an on-ramp if Canada wanted to participate?
I think it's an internal Canadian discussion. These are the kinds of things that we will leave to Canadians to decide whether it's important for them to participate or not. As of right now, they don't participate, and I'll just leave it to the Canadian people to make a decision.
I think I should surely win a prize, 22 minutes, and neither of us has said Keystone.
I think my time's up now, isn't it? No, just kidding.
Several months ago, the ask coming out of Canadian officials is, why can we not just have a decision?
You know, this is, first of all, we appreciate the challenge of this decision process and how serious Canadians take it, and we take it equally serious. There are citizens on both sides of the 49th parallel that have very strong opinions as to the outcome of this. We've asked by law for a comment of folks, and we owe them the legal responsibility to review those comments. So on Good Friday when we announced this, that was one of the two important points that we raised. The second is the uncertainty that has been created as a result of the Nebraska court system. And as a result of the uncertainty under Nebraska, we basically said you have extended time. We have not put a final timeline on that at this point, but we gave them extended time because they need it.
There are some commentators in Canada who say if we had any skill at reading between the lines, we would understand that this much delay is our answer. The answer is no.
We have commentators, I've read those that have said it's going to be absolutely yes, it's going to be no, and it's going to be in between. Whatever those folks are doing is they're just speculating at this point.
That was Maclean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with the new U.S. ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman.
Keeping with news from the U.S. this week, President Barack Obama announced new greenhouse gas regulations for coal-burning power plants in the United States. The president's move on America's largest source of GHG emissions has renewed questions about when Canada will act to regulate our biggest source of emissions, the oil and gas industry. The Harper government says it wants to act in concert with the United States, but the opposition parties are pushing the government to act now. I'm joined now by NDP environment critic Megan Leslie. So Megan, first of all, we had the big announcement from the president of the United States this week about GHG emission regulations for their coal sector. Your response sort of this week was to ask the government to move forward with the oil and gas sector. What exactly would you like the government to do?
Well, I would like for Canada to take its climate change obligations seriously. I would like to actually go back to the old numbers that we agreed to under Kyoto, but we've withdrawn from those commitments. So, you know what, I'm resigned to the fact that we are dealing with weaker targets that were agreed to in Copenhagen. So let's focus on those. I don't know how in the world we're going to meet them. So what I would like to see is government figure out how to meet these targets.
The Canadian government has said that, you know, they want to act in concert with the United States when it comes to oil and gas. Do you have any concerns that if we acted now, if we went forward with regulations or cap and trade as the NDP has proposed, that that would present a competitiveness problem for all our oil industry?
I don't think so, for a number of reasons. First of all, you'll see that some of our provinces have prices on carbon. There is a carbon tax in British Columbia. Quebec is part of a cap-and-trade system with California, of all places. And then there's a form of taxation on carbon in Alberta. And you know what? Those provinces are doing fine. You know, one of the provinces is Alberta, right, where the oil and gas sector predominantly is located. So I don't think it will be a competitive disadvantage at all. In fact, I think it's the contrary. And when President Obama announced these regulations to the coal sector, there was a lot of initial reaction saying, holy smokes, the coal industry is going to freak out here. They're going to start lawsuits. It's going to hit their economy. So there was this initial sort of mini explosion around that issue. But then the EPA came forward, and I don't remember the name of the gal who was speaking at the press conference, but the person who was representing the Environmental Protection Agency said, this is an opportunity for us. America has an opportunity before it to stimulate its green economy, to pursue these green jobs, to look at innovation in our green sector, our environment sector. So I think that there's tremendous opportunity here for us as well with the oil and gas sector.
So the NDP has in the past proposed cap and trade. I assume that will be the proposal in 2015.
Yes, we're committed to cap and trade.
How, I guess, first of all, the issue with putting a price on carbon, one of the issues that has been raised is this idea that to get to the Copenhagen targets, it's been suggested that we might have to put a price as high as $100 per ton on GHG emissions. I mean, is the NDP prepared to go that far, that high?
Well, with cap and trade, the thing that is set is not the price. The thing that is set is the cap. So we would say this is the cap, and actually, I'll tell you right now, we're working on trying to actually put a revised number on things because everything's a little bit out of date these days. So we are working right now to we'll be able to present what we think a cap should be and how it should work. But you put a cap on emissions, and you say, come on, you got to meet this cap, and then there is a market system or a trading system that develops as a result of the cap. That's how it's different than a carbon tax, where you put a price on carbon emissions. So price on carbon is essential, but you know what? It's not the only answer, and it can't be the only answer. It won't work if that's the only thing we do. We also have to look at how we bring down emissions in other ways, and some of those ways are really simple. It's not rocket science. We know how to do this, like the Eco Home Energy Retrofit Program, right? This way, we help people save money. We bring down their costs on energy. We create jobs in communities where there are auditors, where there are the home renovation experts who know how to do these kinds of renovations. But we're also bringing down emissions. So something as simple as insulating your roof or choosing the right fridge is really important to us bringing down our emissions. Taking that $1.3 billion of subsidies to the oil and gas sector that currently exist and instead putting them with an emerging sector, the renewable sector, that's another step that has to be done. It's all of these pieces together. I'm not going to hang my whole hat on cap and trade. It's got to be all these pieces. And that's where the real opportunities are for us when it comes to job creation and when it comes to stimulating our economy and that transition to the green economy as well.
But even if you're not necessarily setting a price strictly through a carbon tax, there's going to be a cost here. And, you know, a cap to get us to Copenhagen is conceivably going to have to be fairly stringent. And that's going to come with a cost. And that's going to, you know, have some impact on the economy. Like, how big of a cost is the NDP, I guess, basically willing to impose?
Well, here's the thing. There is going to be a cost. You cannot deny that. But we've seen report after report that says the sector-by-sector approach taken by the Conservatives right now is actually more costly. It's not done in a strategic way. It's done haphazardly, and it actually ends up being more costly to Canadians, only we don't see it. Right, you can't put your finger on it. It's that companies figure out ways to make items more expensive, but you don't see the actual cost, right? The other piece about cost that's really, really important to remember is the cost of climate change, and that is happening now. Right? We're coming up, the beginning of July will be the 1-year anniversary of the flood in Toronto. tell me about, like, let's look at how many folks still have their insurance claims waiting because of flooded basements. Let's look at, you know, destruction to or problems that people have had with infrastructure because of floods. Let's look at the fact that we are paying out to farmers who get caught in droughts. I know droughts have happened since time immemorial, but these kinds of major weather events are happening more frequently, and it's costing us money. The most recent report out of the U.S. talked specifically about the costs to us, whether it's our healthcare system because more kids have asthma, whether it's you know, crumbling infrastructure on our coastlines, whether it's helping out farmers in times of drought. This is costing us money. But those kinds of costs somehow aren't factored in by the Conservatives, right? Or by this current government. They're acting like they don't exist, but they do exist. And we have to acknowledge that.
That was NDP environment critic Megan Leslie.
Coming up, we talk about the problem with accessing information from the federal government, and we get a recap of all the action this week in the House of Commons. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up, we have our QP in review, but first, the Federal Information Commissioner, Suzanne Legault, released her annual report this week. It found that complaints about the government refusing to release documents under the Access to Information Act are up an eye-popping 30%. Some of that increase had to do with events such as a flood of requests to Transport Canada for info on the Lac-Mégantic rail disaster.
But most of the logjam results from a combination of big demand for info and the reluctance to provide it. Legault spoke with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about her report.
Why are complaints up so much? 30% seems like a lot.
Well, there's been an increasing number of requests overall in the system as well. So two years ago, 12-13, we saw an increase of 27%, close to 28% increase in requests overall in the system. So we do have a corresponding increase, a slightly more increase in complaints in our office.
Is it, I can think of two broad ways to discuss this. One is to wonder whether or not there aren't enough resources in the system to administer and deal with all the requests there are for information under the Act, and the other is that officials in control of information are more reluctant to release it. Do you think it's a mix of those two, or do you put more of the burden of blame in one area or the other?
We have a real mix. We have some institutions like Citizenship and Immigration Canada, which basically carries the government's statistical performance, doing very well in absorbing this increase.
They respond quickly and efficiently.
Yes, but also their requests are more routine, and they don't have a lot of pages. On the flip side, you have other institutions like the RCMP or Transport Canada who actually did not handle the year well at all. And so you have some institutions that really have very high levels of difficulty for different reasons. At Transport Canada, it was really the surge in response to the number of requests dealing with the Lac-Mégantic tragedy.
I see.
And at the RCMP, it was more in terms of the resources levels in the RCMP at the time. So two very different reasons. Both institutions are addressing it now, but we had, during that year, a very mixed performance overall.
Could I ask about one area or one group of areas, the national security, defense, international affairs cluster, where I know there are a lot of complaints. In that area, is there just a sort of a clash between the demands or the sense in people, the minds of people making requests that they should be able to get information, and a strong culture of secrecy in those parts of government?
They are highly sensitive files. Everyone, including investigators in my office, are extremely cautious in handling these files, in reviewing these files, and in applying the exemptions under the Act. And I think that that's fair. There has to be a very serious scrutiny and a proper balance given to the national security files, because there is an interest in protecting some security-related information, and there is an interest in ensuring that the information that should be disclosed is disclosed. So it's a very fine balance. I think that there is probably, following the Snowden revelations, a very strong push towards more transparency in security-related files. And in fact, this year, there have been some releases of information that I think we would not have seen before.
Interesting.
So there is a movement going on in terms of transparency related to national security, but we have had a significant increase in requests on those files this year.
As a journalist, I've run into the cabinet confidence exclusion quite often. I know that's an area you flagged before. Can you tell me the state of your thinking on that? How should that rule be changed? It's the rule that prevents or allows information to be withheld if it's basically gone to cabinet.
The main problem that I have with cabinet confidences is not that they would be protected under the Act. I think that that's perfectly legitimate. I think the issue is that if they are protected as an exclusion, they're excluded from the application of the Act, and that's where I really disagree with the way the Act is structured in that respect, because that means I don't have the ability to review the records.
Which means someone, you have to take someone's word for it. When they say it's cabinet confidence, it's cabinet confidence, whether, and you don't get to check to see whether that holds up.
That's correct.
So in a national security matter, let's say someone says, well, we can't release this, it's a matter of national security, you get to check to see whether that holds up. But if someone says, we were not releasing this because it's a cabinet confidence, in that area, well, that's the end of the line. You don't get to see that and double check someone's thinking on whether something really is a cabinet confidence or not.
That's correct. What we see in terms of cabinet confidences is a description of the records and a schedule.
Could I finally ask about the new strategic plan you have in the works? What do you hope to achieve with that?
We're going to do a big push towards the mediation component. We're going to really try to settle cases at the onset, very quickly with complainants and institutions.
Sort of step between them and help them work things out rather than having to issue orders, that sort of, or not an order, but issue a finding.
Yeah, really try to tackle the complex cases right away. I'm hopeful that this will allow us to settle matters more quickly to the satisfaction of both the complainants and reduce the burden on institutions.
That was Federal Information Commissioner Suzanne Legault speaking with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
And now it's time for our question period and review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on McLean's.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
The Commons ambled ever closer to summer this week. On Monday, Prime Minister Stephen Harper chuckled repeatedly as he rose in the House. Harper put on his best condescending tone, and no matter what Tom Mulcair asked, the PM's reply was the same. The guy across the way? He's a conspiracy theorist.
Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition today has shown he's unaware of the Canada-Europe Free Trade Agreement, unaware of the government's GHG reduction emissions for the electricity sector, Mr. Speaker, and thinks somehow that 30-year serving public servants are part of a vast right-wing conspiracy, Mr. Speaker. That's why that the NDP is going nowhere.
On Tuesday, Liberal MP Chrystia Freeland asked the government why it can't conclude free trade negotiations with Europe. She insisted that no final text means no done deal. Gerald Keddy, the Parliamentary Secretary on International Trade, replied with one of the laziest answers of the parliamentary session.
I would like to welcome her to the trade file and to the international trade portfolio. Congratulations. This is her first question on a trade file. Certainly not a priority for the third party. I also note that she missed 20 meetings of the International Trade Committee and missed 69 witnesses. Come on. Now, you want to ask questions on a trade file? You should learn it first.
On Wednesday, Justice Minister Peter MacKay teased the government's approach to filling the next Supreme Court vacancy later this year. He assured his colleagues that the Tories will consult widely, but it sounds like he's lost faith in a parliamentary selection committee normally charged with sending a shortlist of worthy judges to the PM.
Of course, we intend to again consult widely and certainly within Quebec, and certainly, Mr. Speaker, with those in the legal community. But we are concerned with the process and the compromise that occurred and the leaking of information around it the last time. And so, Mr. Speaker, we will proceed with caution and haste in the future.
Yeah. MacKay remained front and center on Thursday, a day after he'd tabled a bill meant to revise Canada's prostitution laws.
Given the immediate backlash the bill faced in the sex worker community, the NDP might have taken a harsh line in the Commons. Not so, at least not so far.
In less than 24 hours, the Justice Minister's new bill already has legal experts predicting long court battles over whether or not it respects the Charter, the Constitution, and the Bedford ruling of the Supreme Court of Canada. So will the minister skip his divisive talking points? Will he do the sensible thing and refer this bill to the Supreme Court of Canada immediately?
No more than a fortnight remains before the House rises for the summer. Barbecues are smelling better by the day.
Once again with Question Period in Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.